Senator Moynihan that he had been the secretary to Governor Harriman at the time of the determination of the Stony Brook Mission, and he claims to have played a major role in asserting that there ought to be a major university center in the downstate region, and namely the center that was designated for Stony Brook.
I didn't know that.
So I think the Stony Brook Council must be given a great deal of credit for having taken the drives and ambitions of the faculty at Stony Brook and having pushed them hard to become a part of the Hills Commission report. And the early faculty leaders at Stony Brook, administrative leaders like Dr. Hartzell, Dr. Kelver, Dean Ross, Dean Fox, Alexander Pond, were key in keeping the vision of a major university clear and getting it accepted in the Hill Commission report and in the later planning of the SUNY system. There was also a Wells Committee report which developed, under Herman Wells, the kind of funding and support guidelines that were necessary to the real development of a major center. So all of these studies were extremely important and were often used by those of us at Stony Brook in arguments with more conservative members of the central administration.
That cover seven?
Well, no, it covers six, I think. I think when I arrived at Stony Brook, there had been general acceptance, therefore, so it should be developed into a major university center with undergraduate and graduate work and excellent research, and should include at that location, though not necessarily as part of the Stony Brook campus, the health sciences. Its overall mission was therefore set. To answer the question seven, my impression starting when I first came there was there was really an outstanding group of people there. They were thoroughly committed to the development of an outstanding university. They understood the work that would be required to do this, and they were tremendously dedicated to it. There was a spirit that I guess is like that in a new country when it's being funded. You had somewhat the same spirit among the founders of the American nation. The people were willing to sacrifice everything for the goal that they had developed and shared together. And I was really tremendously impressed by the faculty and administrative leaders at Stony Brook when I first came there. There had been a lot of strife, and people were determined to put that strife behind them and work together for the development of the university. The campus was still in early stage of development, and many additional facilities were badly needed, and for the first 2 years, everyone's impression was of a great deal of mud. I can remember, indeed, the students in the early years protesting the mud by bringing cups and stacking them outside my office door. But we were all aware that we had to accept a certain amount of disruption in the early years for the sake of the eventual goal, and most of the people were willing to make tremendous sacrifices in order to build the university. I think the leadership, it was excellent when I was there. Dr. Hartzell was the administrative officer. The deans were Stan Ross and Tom Irvine and Dave Fox, as dean of the graduate school. And they were really very fine to work with. Each was very capable in carrying out his responsibilities, and they worked very well as a team.
Nine, just the last part of it. Eight, last part of it. Why do you think you were appointed, Johnny?
My impression was it was desperation. That the Stony Brook Council had tried to get many different people, and had been unable to get their first candidate. So finally came to me. I think there was enthusiastic support for me from some of the faculty group.
Yes.
And that helped.
Right.
And
I remember Judge Sullivan asking me if I thought that you would be a good candidate. And I said, yes. Would you go down and interview him?
Well, I do remember when you came down. You asked me that the other day. I do remember you came down and visited me on that Northern Street, my own family home.
Yeah.
Where I lived at the time. And then I also came back up and met with you at Simon Fields. It had stayed overnight at a critical stage in the negotiation.
That was before you went up to Albany.
Yeah, just before, as I remember.
Right.
In preparation for the visit to Albany.
Right.
And that you were extremely helpful in giving me all the background you could on the people I was meeting. And I can't exactly say what was the attitude of others, but I think that the Stony Brook Council supported me, and as I think I said in the first part of this interview, things came to a stymie until Sam Gould was appointed, because the central administrative group of Larry Murray and Harry Porter and Foster and Price and others felt they couldn't move on the many objectives I outlined until Sam was appointed. However, after he was appointed, some months went by, and then I remember going up and meeting with him in Albany in the fall of 1964. Well, this had been, I think, more than about a year or so after, well, at least a good part of the year after my first visit. I'd visited in the previous spring, and at least half a year had gone by, and nothing happening. And then Sam said to me that he couldn't make commitments on all the things that I'd asked, but that he would try to do what he could. And it was on the basis of his just general statement of assurance that I agreed to go ahead.
Well, Judge Sullivan said that, told Sam Gould that before he looked anywhere else for a candidate for Stony Brook, he should interview you. Mm-hmm. In other words, that you were the first choice of the council. And that was its function.
Well, and so I do remember that meeting with Sam, and generally, I feel you have to go on your impressions of people. You can't rely on assurances, because events are going to overtake what both of you have anticipated. You have to really go with the chemistry. And I did feel that Sam Gould had a good vision for the SUNY system as a whole, and did feel the development of Stony Brook was a key part of that. So
you and he worked well together?
I think on the whole, yes. There were times when I thought Sam concentrated more on image than on substance, but I think he did want to help us. I don't know what else I can say about why I was appointed, except there was both the council and the central administration thought it was important to get someone with the title of president of Stony Brook. And as I say, the council was almost exhausted in its efforts and determined to concentrate and pushing me through if possible. I knew that when I arrived, answer question 9, that there were many things still undetermined. There were many mandates that had to be firmed up, issues that had to be settled. And it would take a great deal of work to get those commitments firmed and to build the kind of programs and faculties, support structures that were necessary for the Albany Great University. But at least the possibility of a substantial increase in support had been outlined to me. The willingness to make key appointments had been expressed, and there was a commitment to a substantial capital program that's needed for the future of the university.
Good.
Hey.
Ken?
Well, the key appointments in the early years, I would guess the single most important appointment was probably the appointment of Sian Yang, first as the visiting professor, which had been done just before I arrived, and then the confirmation of his appointment as Einstein professor, which was done on my first day on the job. I took the papers for the Einstein professorship, which had really been worked out by others, to Albany. I had then to see Frank in Princeton and got him to agree to accept the, this was during the period of negotiation, to accept the Einstein professorship if we won it, and then when we won it, I had to go and negotiate it. And it was the first Einstein professorship in the state, so it was important to establish the basis that he was an employee of Stony Brook and that the conditions were written in an optimal way. And I'm glad to say everybody cooperated in seeing that it was set up that way. We recruited other key faculty members that year. That, one I remember particularly is Bob Lekochman came to economics, and he was, that was certainly a step up in national recognition by the economics faculty. But through a whole series of key appointments that we made then as rapidly as we could. On the administrative side, most important appointments, I think, were Bentley Glass as academic vice president, which was also arranged with Sam Lou that previous spring. And there I remember that was one I had to walk through very carefully because it broke so many rules. And Dave Price helped greatly in getting the Division of Budget and others to agree to it. Paul Hartzell as administrative officer. A little bit later, T. Alexander Pond as executive vice president. Then, somewhat later, we got the group expanded and were able to add Sidney Yelba as the vice president for arts and sciences, or liberal arts for liberal studies, and then as eventually to succeed Bentley Glass as academic vice president,
right.
At which time Patrick Heelan became the vice president for liberal studies. We had, I think, a very well-balanced group initially. Alec Pond had a marvelous ability to work well with every group, statewide and level, and a tremendous capacity for work. Bentley Glass was very much committed to academic procedure and proper process and had the kind of national stature that helped us, group of the faculty, to set up good academic relationships. Stan Ross, as the Dean of Arts and Sciences, was really responsible for coordinating the building of most of the departments, and he had good high standards and was very hardworking, and I found tremendously responsive.
I appointed him about a semester after I had gotten on the job because I came down with the title of acting Chief Administrative Officer and Dean of Arts and Sciences, and the two, it was too big a job. And I had worked with Stan on appointing some of the people in his department, and I liked the way he handled his search and the skepticism with which he looked at paper.
I think, in fact, we had a very strong administrative team in those early days that worked extremely well together. Question of the key officers on the administrative side. Sheldon Ackley was already there as an assistant to the president when I arrived, and he became a kind of workhorse who did every assignment that had to be done temporarily until someone else could be appointed. The fiscal situation was, of course, particularly complex as we were trying to set up systems and get things going. We were fortunate to recruit Wilbur Egal from the City University of New York, who came as the chief fiscal officer for quite a period and worked very hard. He, I think, did an outstanding job, but was discouraged by the obstacles he ran into in the central office and finally left. But he moved us forward greatly in the establishment of fiscal systems and operating policies for the university. He was followed later by Joseph Diana, who was a little bit rigid, but who also, I think, helped in maintaining the kind of standards that we needed. The development of the Health Sciences Center was originally planned by a committee group, a conference that was organized by Bentley Glass with help from, I think it was Bob DeZaffra and others. and but then we recruited Ed Pellegrino to come as the head of the Health Sciences Center, eventually getting him titled Vice President for Health Sciences. And he in turn recruited a good people, group of people for the development of the various schools there. I just don't know how far you want me to go in the describing of key people.
Well, I think you probably better continue to the next
right.
question.
All right, the next question is, I think that in general, things developed in accordance with their expectations. There were setbacks, certainly, along the way, which caused some problems. But the Stony Brook, I think, continued to move in the general direction that we expected. After Governor Rockefeller left, there was definitely a slowing down in enthusiasm from the state level and the pressure from the state level, and the fiscal situation of the state turned much tighter as the state came to the rescue. The city's fiscal situation and positions were cut more proportionally, in fact, in Stony Brook than the city university in order to rescue the city. So that was a very difficult period. I would say, overall, the institution we accomplished about, but I felt when I left, we accomplished about half of what I had wanted to do at Stony Brook. We were about half developed towards being an outstanding major scholarly university for the state of New York. They had made a lot of progress, but there was still a lot to do when I left. Personally, for me, I got great enjoyment. I would still be at Stony Brook, except I thought it was in Stony Brook's interest for me to leave, which I'll describe later, I guess. I thought I worked reasonably well with Sam Gould, except sometimes Sam would not follow through on details, but I think he had the right spirit, and he wanted to help. And I will say, I think in times of adversity, like during the drug raid, I think Sam was very supportive and understanding of the university during that key period. After Sam Gould left, Ernie Boyer came in. I would say the relationship varied from time to time. There were periods when I thought Ernie was telling me one thing, and then I'd run out telling other people's others about the expectation of the campus, and that was difficult. I think by the time Ernie's departure, things were working smoothly again. But there certainly were the normal difficulties of any organization when one component is developing rapidly and others are developing less rapidly, that there were strains involved. The Stony Brook's effort to develop was a continual struggle in which I tried to do everything I could to maintain good relationships with the central administration while still not sacrificing the mandate of the campus. But there were times when people in the central administration seemed willing to abandon that mandate, and this would lead to a real struggle. But I would say, on the whole, the relationships with both Sam Gould and Ernie Boyer were good and remain so to this day.
Did you have dealings with Norman Hurd?
I did have dealings with Norman Hurd as director of the budget, although most of my dealings were with underlings. Axelrod came later. Yes, I had dealings with him.
You mentioned Mark.
Mark Martin was, in the early days, the budget examiner for Stony Brook. And I really think he was extremely helpful.
What's his first name?
Was it Ed Martin?
I don't know.
I can't be sure, but he was... I never thought we had a sympathetic budget officer, right? Because they had to approve so many things in the state system. They were totally dependent on your budget officer. In some ways, they had more real power over the campus than the campus officials. And Martin was understanding and would push things through for us and would approve what was necessary for the development of the university. And I really felt he was one of our
the unsung heroes of the development of Tonyville. I come to the question of what events, what persons, what experiences stand out. I guess some of the people who stand out are those I've already mentioned. I have not mentioned Ward Melville, who certainly stands out as the personality who dominated so much of the local community relationships, and his represented in many of the dealings with us was Bayless Matthews. And they, of course, had certain viewpoints of their own, but
Bayless was on the council. And Ward was on
it. Ward had been the first chairman of the council, but when I came, he'd already been succeeded by Justice Sullivan.
Yeah.
But he met with us as honorary chairman of the council, and really still participated. I can remember, for example, when the early council meetings, after I had been selected, but I think before I'd actually gone on the payroll, I came forward with a proposal that we should have our own foundation for fundraising. And Lord Belville immediately volunteered that his lawyers would draw up the papers as a pro bono activity and get the activity launched for us. And similarly, he was, I think, basically supportive of everything we wanted to do for the university. I know though Beta's News was very unhappy when we took the land across from the campus for the Health Sciences Center, because he had the idea of private investment for that.
Well, I remember him telling me, you better get that land soon before somebody else did.
So there's some contradiction.
So I immediately called Herb Gordon, who was the land acquisition man.
Okay.
I told him about it.
And basically, they were supportive. They both, and they guided us in the very rocky relationships with the local town people. Another person who stands out as a personality is Mr. Gabeline, head of the Stony Brook School, who was chairman of a community relations committee for the campus, and who really worked at building good relations between the campus and the community. And one who stands out in a sort of a negative way was Bud Huber, the editor of the Free Village Herald, who continually decried any changes in the campus that he felt were not beneficial to the community, and almost any change he considered not beneficial. So that maintaining relationships with him was difficult, but my main tactic in dealing with him was to always turn the other cheek and try to ignore propagation and emphasize the positive as much as possible.
You had a lot of support within the community.
There was a lot of support within the community, particularly the support of the people from the Brookhaven National Laboratory was important. For example, I remember Victor Bond was very important in the as chairman of a group in the community. He represented the Medical Society in the funding of the Health Sciences Center. Well, that way, since he was totally in sympathy with what we were doing, we had the Medical Society, which usually would fight many of the Rangers' new Health Sciences Center, in fact, cooperating completely and very supportive. Later, Dr. Mahoney played that same role. And so there were friends in the community who helped us just tremendously in the early days of the development.
Had some help from Leland Hayworth.
Leland Hayworth was at Brookhaven, and he helped a lot of the people at Brookhaven help. Of course, George Collins was a member of the council who sort of represented the Brookhaven National Lab on the council, and George was extremely important in keeping other council members supportive of the goal of a major university. But there are two fine people, certainly, in George Collins and Justice Sullivan. I think led the council so that I never had a sense of difficulty in working with the council as a whole. I knew you had to be very careful and respectful of the council, but there was never any doubt of their total support for what we were trying to do and their willingness to give us some free rein in doing it.
A member of the Center of Excellence, Grant, from the National Science Foundation. You remember going down, getting that?
We got a lot of important grants in the early days. were very key to the development, to getting major facilities grants like the Vandegraaff grant and so on. And we were fortunate to be developing in a period when federal funds were available for good competitive proposals, where there was interest in helping developing institutions in Washington. So that we take full advantage of those. I suppose, talking of experiences that stand out, I'm going to have to mention the drug raids.
Yeah.
That in my mind, everything was going very well until those drug raids hit and suddenly created problems for us. It created problems at every level with state leaders like Senator DeFrieda and the State Crime Commission. It created tremendous tensions within the campus because as faculty were arrested, the faculty members expected me to defy the system.